Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company. Today, U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limon. She brings an observant eye and a sense of wonder to all her work. Her latest book, The Hurting Kind, is a finalist for the $130,000 Griffin Poetry Prize. Ada Limon was born in Sonoma, California in 1976, the daughter of an artist mother and school administrator father. Her grandfather had come to the U.S. from Mexico as a child in 1917. After graduating from Sonoma Valley High School, Ada went to Seattle to study drama at the University of Washington. Midway through, she took a poetry class and discovered what she wanted to do with her life. Not that it all happened so easily. She got an MFA in writing from New York University and worked for some years in marketing for popular magazines. At the same time, she was producing poems and published her first collection, Lucky Wreck, before her 30th birthday. She continued writing and gaining recognition with her work appearing in The New Yorker and The New York Times, among other publications. In 2018, her fifth book, The Carrying, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. Now her sixth collection, The Hurting Kind, is shortlisted for the 2023 Griffin Poetry Prize. The winner will be announced on June 7th. Her writing has been widely praised, especially for its force and elegance, while at the same time, often conversational tone. Here's what the Griffin Prize jury had to say. Tinged with grief and longing, and buoyed by wonder in the natural world and the possibility of human connection, these are poems that seem to move effortlessly in the way that only a deft touch can do. The precision of syntax, at once plain-spoken and fiercely lyrical, unfolds its revelations masterfully and with a kind of grace that is often heartbreaking. The Hurting Kind is a marvel. I spoke to Ada Limon from Lexington, Kentucky, where she's been living because of her husband's work with horses. I began by asking her to read the poem Privacy from The Hurting Kind.
Privacy. On the black, wet branches of the linden, still clinging to the umber leaves of late fall, two crows land. They say, stop. And still I want to make them into something they are not. Odin's ravens, the Brujas' eyes. What news are they bringing of our world to the world of the gods? It can't be good. More suffering all around, more stinging nettles and toxic blades shoved into the scarred parts of us, the minor ones underneath the trees. Rain comes while I'm still standing, a trickle of water from whatever we believe is beyond the sky. The crows seem enormous, but only because I'm watching them too closely. They do not care to be seen as symbols. A shake of a wing, and both of them are gone. There was no message given, no message I was asked to give, only their great absence and my sad privacy returning like the bracing, empty wind on the black, wet branches of the linden.
Ada Limon reading her poem Privacy from her latest collection, The Hurting Kind. Bruja, I understand, is a kind of witch in Spanish. That's just one of the crow's sinister associations, mythic or folkloric. But in this poem, you say the crows do not care to be seen as symbols. What happens when you just watch them closely?
Yeah, I think that's what the project of my life is, to try to figure out what happens when you just watch them closely and let them be. I think it's the impulse of all artists to somehow transform everything we see into something else, to let everything be symbolic, emblematic, a metaphor. And sometimes I think there is a power in just receiving and witnessing the world as it is. And I think a lot of my book, The Hurting Kind, is trying to witness in a pure sense of that word.
I mean, what you've called deep looking is a theme of the book, and it's something that animates many of the poems. What does it take to pay attention in this way? What kind of patience or practice? Do you have to force yourself to slow down?
Well, I think that sometimes what happens to me is that I don't realize I'm rushing until I realize I've missed a whole morning or a whole walk. And that's when I realize, oh, I've just been pushing through and pushing through to what's next and what's coming. And I really need to have those moments where I just stop and I look at something. And just this morning, I was, I have a full day of many different things that I need to do for others. And I looked out on my back porch, and past the crab apple tree was this little baby bunny, and it was so cute. And it had just these, big ears that were sort of too big for its body. And I got to watch it for a while, and I thought, see, if I hadn't been paying attention, I wouldn't even noticed that it was there. And so I really do think that sometimes it's not about forcing it as much as it's asking myself, oh, what have I missed? Or were you paying attention? And a lot of times the answer is, oh, no, you were just, you kept your head down and you were being diligent. You were trying to accomplish the tasks that were laid before you. And sometimes I have to remind myself that living and living fully requires more than that. And it requires an expansiveness and an equanimity and some space around everything. And I think that's something I very much work on, not only in my work and my poems, but in my life as a human.
In another poem called The First Lesson, you remember your mother telling you not to be scared as she handles the wing of a dead hawk. Mm-hmm. So I watched, you say, and learned to watch closely the world. How did she teach you that?
I think being raised by a visual artist has a lot of benefits, I think, especially for someone who then goes on to work in language, is that she had this really incredible way of watching and looking at the world that felt like she could see its edges. And I was someone that felt like I couldn't see the edges. For me, everything had an emotional, almost prismatic weight. And for her, she could see the clear lines of how something worked, how it was made, and its functionality. And I think because she's a painter and she's still a painter, I get to be able to see not only how she witnesses the world, but then how different it is from the way that I see the world. And I think I learn a lot from her way of looking and hope that I can sometimes take something from that and move it into my own work.
Well, her paintings are on the covers of your books. Does that happen together? I mean, does she look at the content or do you choose a painting from what she's already done?
She's an incredible painter. And what I do is I send the finished manuscript to her. And then we have a long phone conversation after she reads it. And I mention a bunch of words, things that are themes or through lines, or even if I see colors when I think about the work, or and she writes those on her studio wall, and then from there she creates a series of paintings, and each time she sort of graced me with the. With the privilege of going in and choosing the one that I want as the cover from the series.
Many of the poems in your collection, The Hurting Kind, were inspired by watching animals. How did they come to have such a strong presence in your work?
One of the things that I think about is that we often don't realize how many animals are around us at all times, whether it's just, you know, whether they're the ants on the kitchen table or carrying the crumb or opening the peony, or whether they're the bunnies in the backyard or the fox that comes and goes. And I think that for me, the witnessing of those animals helps me to remember that I am animal. And that gives me a sense of being connected to something larger, that gives me a more holistic view of my relationship to the world. And even when I was young, I loved the smaller worlds within the larger human world, right? The watching any kind of animal walk on a blade of grass, or looking at the roly-polies or the potato bugs, or, you know,
what are roly-polies? I only knew them as a kind of strudel.
Oh, yeah. So a roly-poly, I'm sure it has a brilliant name that I don't know, but it's the little gray bug that rolls into a ball if you touch it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a very sweet little bug. But yeah, I think that all of those things made me feel more alive every time I was able to be in their presence, and they still do.
You've suggested that poets have a more tender relationship to the world than other people. Is it this tenderness or openness that leads them to poetry, or does the practice of poetry heighten the receptivity?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. And I'm not sure what comes first. And maybe it changes for each individual artist. But I do think that artists in general do have an openness. And, you know, they need to receive the world. They need to listen to the world in order to write toward the world. And they also have to feel as if there is something of value in their speaking back to the world. We are tenderhearted. And sometimes that can make that sense of overwhelm more traumatic for those of us that work in the arts. So I always feel like it's important to practice caretaking and talk about caretaking, what it is to make sure that that you keep writing poems forever and that you feel good doing so.
Well, the title poem in your collection, The Hurting Kind, is just about that, what it means to be sensitive and open to the world. It's the centerpiece of the collection and the longest poem in it. Can you say what inspired it?
What inspired it originally was my grandfather on my mother's side had passed away. And when I flew back for the funeral plans, and we actually got to him right before he passed away. So we knew he was dying. We got the call and we rushed out to the West Coast. And as soon as he was gone, my grandmother turned to me and she said, "Now teach me poetry." And it was so incredible. And I kept holding that in my heart. And that's where the poem sort of began. And then I needed to explore what it was that was their connection, and what it is also to be an artist, sometimes among people who are not artists and yet are worthy of every kind of storytelling there is.
What do you think your grandmother wanted you to tell her? I mean, you say, "Teach me poetry," at that point.
I think she wanted two things. I think part of her wanted a distraction from grief. And then I think that, like any artist, and definitely like what poets do very often, is she wanted a container for her grief. And that's what poetry provides. And so I think, you know, it's that idea of the formal feeling that comes, as Emily Dickinson said. And so I feel like she wanted some kind of container that she could not only explore her loss, but maybe practice some kind of resurrection as well.
And in a way, you had a model for this kind of sensitivity in your own maternal grandfather. I mean, can you tell me a little more about him?
You know, when I think about him, I immediately think of really sensitive, sweet, kind eyes. And he was always tearing up when he would tell you a story. And then he was also someone who worked primarily with his hands. And so he had these very tough, rugged hands. And he was a tall man and had a rugged exterior. And I think of how often he was asked to be tough. He was a soldier in World War II. And I think very often of what he saw in the Battle of Anzio and Cassino. And I think that that stuck with him his entire life. And it wasn't something he was able to speak about or was asked to speak about. Instead, like most soldiers returning from war, whether they were drafted or had enlisted, they aren't asked about that experience. They're instead asked to press that down and continue living as if nothing happened. And you could see that within him. You could see his tenderness and his power sort of at odds at times. And I still feel sometimes when I think about kindness, he's someone that immediately comes into my mind.
We have this line in the poem, and it's in the I voice. I won't assume it's you, but the I voice is saying, "I have always been too sensitive, a weeper from a long line of weepers. I am the hurting kind. I keep searching for proof."
Mm-hmm.
What kind of proof?
Yeah. And you can presume the speaker is me in these poems.
Thank you.
Definitely are. Yes, yes. I think that for me, it's that proof that all of the suffering is worth it, that all of the love and loss is worth it. And I think that in witnessing and writing and transforming and making art out of these big momentous things that happen when we lose someone, I think I again and again am trying to make sure that their life was worth it, that they were witnessed and they were beheld. So I think that's the kind of proof I'm looking for.
Could you read another poem for me? This one is called Against Nostalgia, and it's also from your newest book, The Hurting Kind.
Yeah, here you go. Against Nostalgia. If I had known back then you were coming, when I first thought love could be the thing to save me after all, if I had known, would I have still glued myself to the back of his motorcycle while we flew across the starless bridge over the East River to where I grew my first garden behind the wire fencing in the concrete raised beds lined by ruby twilight roses? If I had known, it would be you, who even then I liked to look at, across a room, always listening rigorously, a self-questioning look, the way your mouth was always your mouth. Would I have climbed back on that bike again and again until even I was sick with fumes and the sticky seat too hot in the early fall? If I had known, would I have still made mistake after mistake until I had only the trunk of me left, stripped and nearly bare of leaves? If I had known, the truth is, I would have kneeled and said, sooner, come to me sooner.
Ada Limón reading her poem Against Nostalgia from her collection, The Hurting Kind. The poem carries a lot of emotional weight, but where does nostalgia come into it?
You know, I think that there's many people who will say, you know, oh, you know, if we had just met sooner, we would have had longer time together, or, you know, or they'll say the opposite, which is, you know, we met at exactly the right time. If we'd met sooner, we would have wrecked each other, you know, all those kind of things. And I wanted to kind of play with the idea of what would it be if instead of thinking, okay, everything happens for a reason and we met exactly when we were supposed to meet, what if I sort of pushed against that a little bit? And instead of thinking, oh, I had all these memories before my husband came into my life, instead of that, what if I thought of him entering it sooner? And honestly, it brought me so much pleasure to think of him in my life before so many, you know, others. I thought, oh, yes, actually, the answer for me is I would have said sooner.
It's such a gift to him. How did he respond? Or does he take these things personally in your poetry?
You know what? He's one of my very first readers of every poem. And no, he was very moved by this poem the first time he read it. Well, actually, I read it to him on the couch, which is how often he hears poems.
That's the best way.
I think so.
Ada Limón, you've described poetry as a place where you can be yourself, a place of freedom. In what way?
You know, I think that poetry resists an easy summation. And I think it's so often that people want you to tell them who you are. And we can't, right? We're too many things. You know, as the great Papa Whitman said, you know, we contain multitudes, and we do. And I think poetry is that place where that exploration and that mystery and the space between the chaos and the calm all exist at once. And I think that, for me, is a kind of freedom, because it's not the sort of easy soundbite that so often people want from us, and even our loved ones want from us, you know, how are you? Fine. You know, they want us to be good, and they want the answer to be easy. And I want that from my friends, right? But sometimes it's more complicated. And I think I trust poetry because it makes so much room for that kind of complication and for that kind of not unease with the world, but maybe the mystery of the world and the mystery of our existence. And to me, that feels like freedom.
Perhaps it's no surprise to hear that you've been a singer-songwriter. Have you turned any of your poems into songs, or would a song take shape differently?
You know, they're actually, it's very different for me, because the song has all of the different elements that it will work with, right? It's going to work in tandem. It's going to work with a harmony and a melody. It's going to have a bass line. It's going to have the benefit of music around it. And so you can play with it in a different way, because all of the elements coming together make the complete song. And a poem, as opposed to lyrics, has to do all of that work on the page by itself. It has to be complete. It has to be the full orchestra. It has to be the whole backing band. It has to be the choir. And so that's the kind of the fun thing about making a poem, is that it must stand alone as the whole finished song, whereas lyrics are really the beginning of something, and then the music fills it out. And with a poem, the music all has to be there.
You once imagined a career on stage, or perhaps behind the stage, before you discovered poetry, and mm-hmm. your undergraduate degree was in theater. What's the relationship for you between writing and performing as a poet? I mean, what do you bring to poetry from your theater studies, do you think?
The biggest thing, I think, is breath. I think that every time I'm, you know, whether it's just giving a reading or even composing poems, I think, you know, it's always coming back to the breath and being alive in the body. And then that idea of really wanting to connect to an audience and recognizing that there is a reader on the other end of it. I don't always write a poem thinking about the reader, but I revise a poem thinking about the reader. That's when I think, is this for someone else? Maybe it's just for me. Maybe it goes in the drawer, you know? Or maybe it's meant to go out into the wider world. And I think you don't make theater to just perform it alone in your room. And sometimes you make poems just for yourself. And so for me, I think recognizing when a poem really needs to be outreaching and go to meet a reader is important as well. And I think theater also taught me that.
I'd like you to read another poem, and this one is called Drowning Creek. It's also from your latest book, The Hurting Kind.
Yeah. Drowning Creek. Past the strip malls and the power plants, out of the hauler, past Gun Bottom Road and Brassfield, and before Red Lick Creek, there's a stream called Drowning Creek, where I saw the prettiest bird I'd seen all year, the belted kingfisher, crested in its Aegean blue plumage, perched not on a high snag, but on a transmission wire, eyeing the creek for crayfish, tadpoles, and minnows. We were driving fast toward home, and already our minds were pulled taut like a high black wire latched to a utility pole. I wanted to stop the car, to take a closer look at the solitary stocky water bird with its blue crown and its blue chest and its uncommonness. But already we were a blur and miles beyond the flying fisher by the time I had realized what I'd witnessed. People were nothing to that bird, hovering over the creek. I was nothing to that bird, which wasn't concerned with history's bloody battles or why this creek was called Drowning Creek, a name I love, though it gives me shivers because it sounds like an order, a place where one goes to drown. The bird doesn't call the creek that name. The bird doesn't call it anything. I'm almost certain. Though I am certain of nothing. There is a solitude in this world I cannot pierce. I would die for it.
Ada Limón reading her poem Drowning Creek from her collection The Hurting Kind. Those last lines, there is a solitude in this world I cannot pierce. I would die for it. What are you saying there?
I think there's something about the protection that I want to offer other lives. And I want that bird to remain free. And I want that bird to not be worried about the human condition. And to not be able to pierce that bird's world entirely is beautiful to me, and it's sacred to me. And I think that sometimes when we feel like we understand so much, whether it's scientifically or religiously or whatever it is that makes us feel like we somehow have a knowing, I like to push against that and protect the unknowing.
I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Ada Limón, I'd like to hear a little more about your background and growing up in Northern California. Can you tell me a bit about your family life and the environment that shaped you?
Yeah, I'm from a small town in Northern California called Sonoma, and I also was raised in Glen Ellyn. They're about 15 minutes apart. So when my parents separated, my father and stepmother lived in Glen Ellyn, and my mom and stepdad lived in Sonoma. So they're very close. Sonoma is the central sort of, it has the plaza, and it's known for its very world-famous wines. And Glen Ellyn is a little smaller, but it also has a lot of different beautiful vineyards. And so I was raised in this valley that's actually called the Valley of the Moon. And it was a really special place that I am still deeply connected to. And I think that the landscape was as much a part of my growing up as you know, my siblings and my parents, because we were in between the Mayacamas mountain range and the Sonoma mountain range. And they're low hills, they're low mountains. But, you get this feeling like you're surrounded on both sides by these gentle giants. And then in between is sort of a softness. And that's where the grasses are and the many, many different kind of oak trees and, you know, the wild poppies and wildlife. And, you know, I also grew up with both my father and stepmother, and my mother and my stepdad were really good at naming plants and animals, whether they were the coastal plants or flowers, or if they were just the things right in front of us, which was anytime you'd point to something, they would know it. And that was a gift to me. This is what you did. This is how you knew your environment and how you respected your environment, was to know the names of things.
Your parents' divorce must have been difficult for you when you were only 8 years old, but you've described yourself, at least in retrospect, as lucky. In the opening of your poem, Joint Custody, you ask, why did I never see it for what it was, abundance? How have you come to see it that way?
You know, I think that so often we think that because our lives aren't like someone else's lives, that they aren't beautiful. And I think as a kid, I felt like there was some sort of failure, right? Some kind of brokenness that happens if you have four parents. And then I kept thinking, and this was in the early days of the pandemic when I was isolated from my family and I missed them so much. And I thought, my first thought was, oh, aren't I lucky to have so many people to miss? That's where that poem came from. Because missing is loving, right? And it's not that I'm always interested in reframing, although I do think that's very important. I think it's also about losing old stories that aren't useful anymore and losing the things that we, again, it's sort of resisting summation again. It's the thing that's the soundbite. It's the thing that, oh, right, you know, your parents were divorced, so things must have been hard. And it's easy for you to say yes. But I think sometimes it's harder to say, well, no, it wasn't that hard. I mean, it was maybe the same as you in some ways, where it was hard and also good, and like anyone growing up with other human beings, right?
Although have a line, you have the I have two brains now. This is in the poem, two entirely different brains. The one that always misses where I'm not, and the one that is so relieved to finally be home. So, I mean, it's complicated.
Yeah, that is very true. And I think that's the other thing about that poem, is that it's speaking about that abundance and that beauty, but then also speaking about what it was to always exist with missing, right? To always have that in your heart. You know, what was it to be totally and completely home with your mother and your stepdad and having a wonderful dinner, and then think, I wonder what my dad is doing right now. I wonder what my stepmom, I wonder what they're eating. Like, I grew up in that way, right? Always missing and then always feeling home. And I think that that has given me something. I'm not sure if I can even define it yet, but I know it's deeply part of who I am.
You paid tribute to your parents in a number of poems, and your father, who was an elementary school principal, is the subject of My Father's Mustache in The Hurting Kind. It's such a wonderfully vivid poem. Could you read it?
Yes, thank you. My Father's Mustache. Let us pause to applaud the white bell-bottom suit, the wide flared collar, the black thick coiffed hair. In this photo, my father has sent of himself at a gathering off Sonoma Highway in the early 70s. I can't stop looking at the photo. There is a swagger that feels almost otherworldly, epic, like Lorca expounding in Buenos Aires, not the form, but the marrow of form. He is perfect there, my father in the photo. I feel somehow as if I am perched on a bay laurel branch nearby, though not born yet. It's in black and white, the photo. You can see his grin behind his lush mustache. Is it time that moves in me now? A sense of ache and unraveling. My father in his pristine white suit, the eye of the world barely able to handle his smooth, unbroken stride. It's been a year since I've seen him in person. I miss how he points to his apple trees, and I miss his smooth face that no longer has the mustache I always adored. As a child, I once cried when he shaved it. Even then, I was too attached to this life.
Ada Limon reading her poem, My Father's Mustache, from her book, The Hurting Kind. When because of COVID, you hadn't seen your father for a year, you couldn't stop looking at the photo, which dates from a time before you were born. Do photos or some photos also require that kind of deep looking we were talking about initially?
Yeah, I love, even when I was a child, I loved my parents' photo albums. I love looking at my grandparents, you know, and thinking of them as young people. And I also feel like there's just so much humanity when you can see past the person that only you knew as a parent and then see them as before they were a parent, or see them even as a child. And I don't know, that's always been something that's super fascinating to me, because it somehow humanizes the person that is identifiable as one thing to us, a mother, a father, a husband, a partner, right? And looking at those photos, I think, allows for an expansiveness of your own identification of that person.
Well, you also wonder, how can they exist without you? You know,
yeah.
The fact that they had a life before you entered the world.
Yeah. And I, for some reason, I've always loved that. You know, it made me feel like, of course you did. You know, we didn't know each other then. How funny.
Your paternal grandfather was Mexican. What can you tell me about him?
Yeah, Francisco Carlos Limón, or Frank. He was from San Juan de los Lagos in Jalisco. He crossed the border as a child, and his mother had passed away, and he was put in foster care. So he was raised by foster parents. And he knew very much that he wanted to be serious. He wanted to be a very good American citizen. And yet really in his heart was so much of a jester in some ways and a singer. He was a great dancer, had a beautiful, booming voice. In fact, both my grandfathers had great voices. And so I always think of, when I think of them, I think of them singing. He was a very good soul that I lost when I was just as I was graduating from college, and miss him dearly.
I'd like you to read a poem you wrote about your grandfather, Heart on Fire.
Be happy to. Heart on Fire. As a foster child, my grandfather learned not to get in trouble. Mexican and motherless, dead as she was from tuberculosis, he practiced words in a new language and kept his slender head down. When the other boys begged him to slip into the music shop's upper window to steal harmonicas for each of them, music being important, thievery being secondary, he refused. When the cops came to spot the boys who robbed the music store, they could easily find the ones spitting broken notes into the air, joyously mouthing the stainless steel, mimicking men on street corners busking for coins. But not my grandfather. He knew not to risk it all for a stolen moment of exaltation. It's easy to imagine this is who I come from, a line of serious men who follow the rules. But might I add that later he was a dancer, a singer, an actor whose best roles ended up on the cutting room floor, a cut-up, a ham who liked a good story, who would have told you life was a series of warnings, but also magic. Once he was sent for a box of matches, and he put that box of strike anywheres in the pocket of his madras shirt and ran home. He ran so fast to be on time, to be good, and when he did so, the whole box ignited. So he was a boy running down the canyon road with what looked like a heart on fire. He'd laugh when he told you this. A heart on fire, he'd say, so you'd remember.
Ada Limon reading her poem Heart on Fire from her latest collection, The Hurting Kind. In the poem, you describe your grandfather as a cut-up, a ham who liked a good story. What kinds of things did you learn from him about how to be in the world?
You know, I think he was very interested in signs. He, you know, if you had an encounter with someone on the bus and they told you something, he would say, you better hold on to that. That's going to come up later. He was very interested in the kind of wisdom that was in the world, that was out there waiting for you. And so even as a child, I remember him telling stories about people he would meet and the things that he was taught along the way. And he wanted me very much to pay attention to those things, to not take those experiences for granted. That's something I've definitely held in my heart. The other thing I think about is joy. You know, I think he knew that he wanted to build a strong foundation, and he did. He had a large family that he had to support, and he really built a strong foundation on which they could all flourish. But at the same time, he loved to cultivate his roses, his garden, you know, the beauty of having orange trees and lime trees and lemon trees in Southern California was such a gift to him. And, you know, he grew up smudging oranges after he crossed the border, and he lived in a chicken coop and then went on to graduate from San Diego State. And I feel like having those experiences, having been someone that was picking oranges for a living and then was able to have his own orange tree that he could call his own, I think was really important to him. And yet at the same time, he would de-emphasize this sort of, you know, anyone defining you. He would push against that too. And I think I've held that as well, which is no story is easy. No story is one thing. Someone else might turn it into one thing, but it's all complicated. And that's something I've also held from him.
Well, if you're looking for the significance of a sign, certainly his heart on fire experience. I mean, I wonder what he made of that. I mean, he obviously liked telling the story, and we hope he wasn't hurt by it. I mean, physically hurt, but like...
Yeah. Yeah, no, he wasn't hurt by it. But I think that for him, it did feel as if most of his life, he was encouraged to be as ordinary as possible, as unseen and unheard as possible. He spoke very highly of his foster parents, but I didn't gather from him that they were very loving. I think that he felt as if he was cared for out of a responsibility, but not out of a place of love. And so I think that story and what he was offering me was that he was still a boy with a heart on fire, with so much to give and so much passion and desire within him. And that no matter what the rules were or the container in which he was given to live, I think he was still himself. And I think that was the sign.
What does it mean for you to have this Mexican heritage? Because you've said you don't like labels, but how do you relate to this part of yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's like the many parts of me. I'm very proud of all of my different ancestors and heritage. And I feel like one of the things that I love about my Mexican ancestry is that, you know, I have a large Mexican family, and it does feel like there's a sense of community behind it, which always has felt like a sense of homecoming, because even though I'm not from Mexico, it does feel like somewhat of a homeland.
Although you're also very capable of being a little bit irreverent about identity, not politics, but just the emphasis on identity. I mean, you have a mischievous poem on that theme in your last book, The Carrying, with the title, The Contract Says We'd Like the Conversation to Be Bilingual. Could you read that one?
Yeah. I think irreverence is always good when it comes to identity. The contract says we'd like the conversation to be bilingual. When you come, bring your brownness so we can be sure to please the funders. Will you check this box? We're applying for a grant. Do you have any poems that speak to troubled teens? Bilingual is best. Would you like to come to dinner with the patrons and sip Patron? Will you tell us the stories that make us uncomfortable but not complicit? Don't read us the one where you were just like us, born to a greenhouse garden. Don't tell us how you picked tomatoes and ate them in the dirt, watching vultures pick apart another bird's bones in the road. Tell us the one about your father, stealing hubcaps after a colleague said that's what his kind did. Tell us how he came to the meeting wearing a poncho and tried to sell the man his hubcaps back. Don't mention your father was a teacher, spoke English, loved making beer, loved baseball. Tell us again about the poncho, the hubcaps, how he stole them, how he did the thing he was trying to prove he didn't do.
Ada Limón reading her poem, The Contract Says We'd Like the Conversation to Be Bilingual, from her 2018 collection, The Carrying. Now, this poem is based on something that you experienced. How did you handle it?
You know, sometimes people want you to participate in something because they see an accent over the O, or they just think, oh, I need to sort of fill this quota or this slot. And you immediately recognize when it's an act of tokenism versus representation. You immediately recognize when someone says, oh, if you can just read your all the poems that you wrote in Spanish, and they have never read your work and they don't realize that you don't write in Spanish, right? So that to me is this recognizing, oh, okay, you're just really looking for a certain identity, not even an artist. And that to me is so limiting and also insulting. And so that's one of the stories in the poem. And then, of course, the second story is the fact that my father was in a faculty meeting that took place in an area of California where another faculty member said, I don't want to park my car there because the Mexicans there will steal my hubcaps. My father, being Mexican, went out and stole all of the man's hubcaps. And it's one of my favorite stories. And he went back in and then dressed in a poncho and a sombrero and really kind of, you know, this sort of cartoonish figure went in and then tried to sell the man his hubcaps back. You know, do you want to buy these hubcaps? And of course, the man was completely humbled and speechless. And it was very interesting because when my father retired from that particular school district, they gave him an engraved hubcap as a way of recognizing all the work that he had done to really overcome stereotypes and push against a lot of the racism that was happening within that certain community.
Ada Limón, your recent poetry book, The Carrying, was preoccupied with the body, dealing with your chronic pain from scoliosis, infertility, aging. I mean, there's a lot of difficult experience in it. Do you feel that writing about these things was a way of working through them for you?
Oh, I hope so. Yes, yes, I do. I do. I absolutely do. I mean, writing is absolutely where I go to get on the other side of something. Absolutely. I always say that for me, writing is a way of saying, you know, okay, this is, where do I put all this? And the poem is the answer. That's what gets to do the carrying so that I don't have to do it all the time. And so I think, it's not only a way of working through something, but also laying it down. And I think laying it down is very important because there's so many parts of us that are hard to hold.
Every book, you say, is a new way of looking at the world and a new you. How does that apply to your latest book, The Hurting Kind? What opened up for you?
You know, I think that The Hurting Kind, for me, has a sense of equanimity in it. A lot of, when you're in graduate school, or when I was in graduate school, I won't use the you there, a lot of my poems were about my family. And of course they are. You know, you're a young poet. I'm starting out trying to figure out what's my material. How do I make poems? And what you have is your life, right? So you make poems out of your life. But I was interested in the fact that I got a lot of pushback against sort of the family poems, the ancestor poems. And it kind of felt like the poems that were not about family were the ones that my workshop and cohort were more interested in. And as I went to go put together my very first book, Lucky Wreck, I thought, what would it be like to sort of not make a book that included all the poems about my mother, my father, et cetera, et cetera? And then I sort of moved on and moved through, and that book got published. And then I went to the next book. And then what's interesting is now I finally given myself the permission that I feel was taken away from me in those early years to write about my ancestors, to really write about my grandmother, my grandfather, my parents, and to give offerings. And I think a lot of this book is a way of saying thank you. And I didn't know it would take me this long to get back to those poems, but I'm really glad I got back to some of that original impulses for making poems that were offerings.
You describe these poems as acts of survival and surrender. Surrender to what?
I think a lot of it is about releasing some idea of what your life might look like, releasing some kind of tight hold you have on future making, and instead surrendering to the beauty of what you have, surrendering to this life. And, you know, I think surrender can be a little bit of a scary word to some people because it can feel like maybe a giving up. But I'm thinking of it more as release or allowing or making space for the appreciation of what this life really is, as opposed to holding on to some idea or forced idea of what life should be.
To go back to your earlier book, The Carrying, I wonder if you could read your poem, The Real Reason. I know it's about family, but now that you've given yourself permission.
Yeah. The real reason I don't have any tattoos is not my story to tell. It's my mother's. Once, walking down Bedford Avenue in my 20s, I called her as I did, as I do. I told her how I wanted a tattoo on the back of my neck, something minor but permanent. And she is an artist. I wanted her to create the design, a symbol, a fish I dream of every night, an underwater talisman, a mother's gift on my body. To be clear, I thought she'd be honored. But do we ever really know each other fully? A silence like a hospital room. She was in tears. I swore then that I wouldn't get one, wouldn't let a needle touch my neck, my arm, my torso. I'd stay me, my skin, the skin she welcomed me into the world with. It wasn't until later that I knew it wasn't so much the tattoo, but the marking, the idea of scars. What you don't know, and this is why this is not my story, is that my mother is scarred from burns over a great deal of her body. most from an explosion that took her first child she was carrying in her belly, others from the skin grafts where they took skin to cover what needed it. She was in her late 20s when that happened, outside her studio in the center of town. You have to understand, my mother is beautiful, tall and elegant, thin and strong. I have not known her any other way. Her skin that I mapped with my young fingers, its strange hardness in places, its patterns like quilts here, riverbeds there. She's wondrous, preternatural, survived fire, the ending of an unborn child, heat and flame and death, all made her into something seemingly magical, a phoenixess. What I know now is she wanted something else for me. For me to wake each morning and recognize my own flesh. For this one thing she made, me, to remain how she intended. For one of us to make it out unscathed.
Ada Limon reading her poem, The Real Reason, from her 2018 collection, The Carrying. Such a powerful poem, a testament to your mother's strength and the deep bond that you share. How did she cope with the trauma she suffered?
You know, I think that like anyone that's gone through that kind of massive bodily and emotional trauma, I think that she's probably still coping with it on some many levels. I think the biggest thing for her, though, was to see me in some ways as that first child returning. That's not in the poem, but it is sort of. And I think that for her was an important way of coping with not only what she went through, but what the future might hold. I think so often about how any of us that live in a body, we think whatever is going on with us is hard. And I think sometimes we forget that other people are going through things too, and it's easy for me to do that. And this poem was written at a moment when I was in a lot of pain, and I kept thinking about my own sort of turmoil with my body. And this poem came out of that when I was really recognizing that not only was I not alone in any kind of bodily pain, but also the woman who raised me went through something that was so much more extreme and managed not only to heal, but really recover in a miraculous way.
You recently became the first U.S. Poet Laureate appointed to serve a 2-year second term. And on June the 1st, you're unveiling a poem that will be engraved on a NASA spacecraft set to travel 1.8 billion miles to explore Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, which is kind of romantic and also mind-boggling. What can you tell me about the poem?
You know, in the making of the poem, which is done, one of the things that I really held close to, which was that in all of the exploration of space, all the scientists, all the people who work at NASA, all the brilliant minds, they know Earth is the best planet. And I think the poem is outreaching. I think it speaks very much to exploration and to Europa, to that second moon of Jupiter. But I think it also very much points back to our Earth, our planet.
Are you really that positive and optimistic?
I think that optimism can be difficult. Positivity can be difficult. When I think about loving the planet, that's not hard for me to do. Worrying about the planet is also not hard for me to do. And I think that we're at a moment of crisis. And so to be able to speak not only toward exploration, but to speak towards what we have here and what we can witness here and what is left for us to wonder at and to caretake, I think that's just as important.
I'm really glad to have the chance to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your wonderful questions.
Ada Limon in Lexington, Kentucky. Her collection of poetry, The Hurting Kind, is a finalist for the $130,000 Griffin Poetry Prize. The winner will be announced on Wednesday. Her books are available in paperback from Milkweed Editions. Today's show was produced by senior producer Sandra Rabinovich with producer Katie Swales. Melissa Gismondi is associate producer. Technical operations by Lara Antonelli. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. Last month, I shared the news that I'll be wrapping up Writers & Company at the end of this season, and I invited you, the listeners, to call in and leave a message for me and the show. I was very moved by the response. Thank you for all your heartfelt messages. I listened to all of them, what can I say, more than once. Here are excerpts from a number of them.
Hi, Eleanor, or should I say hail and farewell. This is Anne Grotrian, 95-year-old Torontonian, and for 90 of those years, I have been a great fan of the CBC and all its wonderful programming. But I must say, of all the programs I have heard, Eleanor, yours was my favorite, and I am going to miss you sorely.
Now, there are so many things I could say about how it is interesting and engaging every time it's on the radio. Your show obviously is widely heard because whenever we travel in the United States, people ask us if we know you. But the true test is whenever we listen to another interview we showed at the radio or TV, why can't you interview like Eleanor?
I know there is nothing permanent in this life or in this world, so as I will take this as a journey where I'll miss you. I'm visually impaired. I don't read the books you mentioned, but you bring the best of the books and best of the authors and best of the conversations. And it has helped me grow so much. It has given me vision with my closed eyes and open ears and open heart.
You have been our familiar and trusty guide through worlds of the imagination.
I can't even remember when I started listening to you, like way back. Definitely listened to you in the car on Sundays. Oh, quick, it's 3 o'clock. Turn on Eleanor. And I have to tell you, all your fans, they all said how they'll miss you. It's all the authors, Eleanor, who are going to miss you. All those new authors who will never have a chance to be interviewed by you, and for you to say kind of quietly, so how did you feel when your father died? It's a catharsis for all of them, and I took such joy in listening and learned so much. You must be the smartest woman on the planet.
To me, Sunday 3 o'clock was sacred, a time to sit, listen, and enjoy your voice. You are a friend I never met.
No matter where in the world we both were, my son would get me linked up to your show on the CBC app. If we were together, we'd do a little dance to the opening song, the distinctive Long As You Know You're Living Yours. And he'd always convince me that it was you, Eleanor, who was playing the saxophone.
So I'm just doing what I love to do. It's a Tuesday afternoon. I'm in the Yukon. I have CBC reception. I'm sitting in my car looking out at spectacular scenery, listening to Writers & Company, and painting with watercolor. It's the best way to spend an afternoon. So thank you so much. I'm just going to miss it. It's going to be such a hole to fill. But Eleanor, you're just an amazing gift. Thank you.
Thank you all for calling and for listening. I'll be sharing more of your messages in the weeks ahead. The number to phone is 416-205-6631. I appreciate hearing from you. Again, that's 416-205-6631. Meanwhile, next week, novelist and poet Michael Ondaatje, in celebration of his Lifetime Achievement Award, the Grand Prix, from Montreal's Blue Metropolis International Literary Festival. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.